Welcome to The Jewish Diasporist, a podcast exploring the political, social, and cultural implications of life in diaspora. We are your hosts, Zach Smerin
and Ben Yanowitz. In this episode, we interviewed Sophie Carden, who recently completed an MPhil in political science at the University of Oxford, studying the history of Yiddish utopian political thought through the writings of Kalman Zingman. Zingman was born in 1889 in Lithuania, then part of the Russian Empire. Following World War I and the Russian Revolution, Zingman set up a publishing house in Kharkiv, Ukraine, through which he pursued a literary career focusing on utopian fiction.
While leaning towards folkism, a non-socialist, non-Zionist diasporist movement led by the renowned historian Simon Dubnov, Zingman became the publisher of a Jewish communist newspaper in Ukraine in 1919. In late 1920, he returned to Lithuania before traveling back to the USSR in 1929, where he died later that year. Would Stalin have had him shot? The world may never know.
In this conversation, Sophie uses utopia to describe a detailed political vision for the future based on one's values and ideological commitments. Zingman imagined a world based on workers' councils, neighborhood assemblies, and national cultural autonomy. Sophie's understanding of utopia contrasts with the colloquial definition of the word as describing a perfect world, and allows us to appreciate the role that utopian fiction can play in developing a positive vision for the future. This is something that we desperately need in this age of somewhat justified hopelessness and less justified cynicism.
This conversation had very good vibes. I worked on the editing of this episode the first time in a few months, and while sometimes conversations can be a bit tiring to go through, it's to do with the flow. All of our guests are great, of course. Editing this episode was quite a pleasure. As three students of history, we were able to properly nerd out, and we were also joined by a very cute dog.
Thank you so much to all our supporters, audience, and donors. The Jewish Diasporist remains a passion project fueled by your continual engagement and support. We need your help to reach as wide an audience as possible. Please follow us on Instagram and share our content with your network. Rate our show on your podcast platform of choice, and consider becoming a monthly donor on Patreon for as little as $1 per month. All your support is deeply appreciated and helps keep this show on the air.
Before we get into the interview, news reached us this morning about an attempted attack on the Bet Yaakov synagogue in La Grande Motte in southern France. Thankfully, no one was seriously hurt. We are still waiting for more information. The news deeply saddened me personally, not only because I had been to this small town twice on holiday as a child, but also because it follows another attempted arson on a synagogue in France, in Rouen, back in May. A solidarité to all those affected, and don't let those who would wish to divide us succeed.
Without further ado, we hope you enjoy the conversation.
They will not divide us. We will not abide this. We know that together we'll be free.
I'm Sophie Carden. I'm an incoming DPhil student at the University of Oxford. I study political philosophy. I just finished my master's. In particular, I work on the history of Jewish political thought in the late 19th, early 20th century that was written in Yiddish. And I have sort of a parallel interest in utopias as a form of political philosophy. I've had sort of a long-time interest in utopia, but it didn't become something that I formally studied until my master's. I also started studying Yiddish when I became interested in both the poetry of Anna Margolin and Celia Dropkin, and in the General Jewish Labor Bund. I come to Oxford with both of these things in hand and think that I'm going to work on something completely different. But I had sort of one little line about utopia and one little sentence about Yiddish political thought in my application. Those sort of grew into a master's thesis and now the dissertation. My grandmother spoke Yiddish, but never with me, certainly not with my father. It was like it is in many families, you know, the language she spoke when the kids weren't meant to understand. And then my grandfather didn't know any Yiddish. He was a Hebraicist, cut and dry, committed Hebraicist. And then the utopia, I'm not sure why. I think I was drawn to it as one of the older forms of political theory. So a lot of people think of, for instance, the Republic as being a utopia. And maybe I should say what I mean by a utopia. I don't mean sort of like a pie in the sky vision of a perfect society, nor do I mean it sort of in like an overinflated sense in which it's often used. For me, utopias are detailed descriptions of ideal societies that don't exist, or at least not yet. And that's a really common and recurring form in political philosophy.
So you use a definition of utopia that I think is a little different from the sort of pejorative that a lot of people on the left might treat utopianism as, something that's like idealistic, something that's not really possible. And you actually do something very different, saying that utopia is a detailed plan of what is possible. So I was kind of wondering if you could lay out a few visions about what that looks like from like a more anarchist perspective, or whether that appeared in different ideological contexts and what that looked like.
So I will say first that I think there are definitely some utopias that are best imaginable utopias, right? You're thinking of the best world that you, within your historical circumstances, can fathom. But you also tend to have best feasible utopias. So those are maybe utopias that, given your circumstances historically, given the technology we have and what people are like, we may actually be able to achieve. And then there are best accessible utopias, which are utopias that, given a few right sort of like transition steps, we might actually reach. So I do think there's room for the best imaginable, perfect, or more or less perfect society ones, and those can be just as well as the others. I mean, you find utopias across all of these different strands. You find them often in literature. So I think Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed is a really interesting example of an anarchist utopia that's actually really self-reflective about its potential flaws. You also have right-wing utopias. Some might say we're living in one. You get them across the political spectrum.
That makes me wonder, is utopia really the right word? Because often when people use it in a more pejorative or offhanded sense, it's something that is like the best possible. And you're kind of very clearly delineating between different types of utopias, between the realms of possibilism and impossibilism, to use the 19th century term.
So I think for me, they're all utopias in that they're the detailed descriptions of ideal societies. I mean, I think I would also want to admit intentional or experimental communities into my understanding of utopia. So those exist in some sense, but they're trying to realize a detailed description of an ideal society. You can call them other things if you want. I think the moniker of utopia is helpful because it's interesting and it catches people's attention and it sort of draws all of these traditions into conversation with one another.
Mm-hmm. So when looking at early 20th century, or a little bit earlier than that, late 19th century writings in Yiddish, this is a time when still there's a lot of discussion about whether Yiddish is even considered a language by many. The first Yiddish publication originated in, I think, the 1850s. A lot of it was in Romania. A Yiddish theater developed during this time. And there was, of course, within the new conditions of or debates between assimilation and Jewish nationalism, the question of using Hebrew and the general Jewish language. And so Yiddish, or various dialects of Yiddish, had this new position of both the language that everybody spoke, at least within a certain Jewish community, within the Pale of Settlement and its diasporas, one might say, in Western Europe or North America. But the fact of using Yiddish itself in this time period would be a statement. How clearly do you see that in the utopias that you look into? Is it something that is clearly connected to the language itself, or is it just a case of these writers were Yiddish speakers and they treat it as something more universal, and language was mostly just a medium for them to get their vision out to the world?
In the utopia that I've spent the most time reading again and again and thinking about, which is Kalman Zingman's In der Zukunftsstadt Edenia, in the future city Edenia, Yiddish plays an incredibly prominent role. So he's both intervening in the language wars, as people sometimes call them, the late 19th, early 20th century, by writing in Yiddish, but he's imagining a Yiddishist utopia. And so what I mean by Yiddishist here, Zingman clearly thinks that Yiddish should hold a preeminent role in modern Jewish culture and Jewish life. He also thinks that it could be used to delineate the national but non-territorial boundaries of the Jewish nation. And what he's doing in part by describing Edenia is trying to think through what under ideal conditions Yiddish would look like. So he imagines, for instance, a scene at a Yiddish university in Edenia. And Edenia is a multinational city. So Jews, Poles, Ukrainians are all living in it together. And it seems to have replaced Kharkiv, Ukraine. So we're sitting in the Yiddish university. A professor is giving a lecture on parrots, and parrots is sort of a rock star. And the professors who write about him are also rock stars. And it's just packed with young Jews who are all listening in awe and debating Yiddish culture and literature. That is really the center of their sort of leisure and their cultural life, is the Yiddish university.
Interesting to mention Kharkiv, considering the situation as it's happening right now. The role of that city historically as well, its connection to Ukraine and Jewish culture and identity.
You mentioned Peretz. Could you say a little bit about his influence as a Yiddish writer and such?
Yeah, a lot of people think of Peretz as, if not the grandfather, then one of the fathers of modern Yiddish literature. He was incredibly important to Zingman, just because I think for him, Peretz was the personified version of the sort of Yiddish high culture that he thought would emerge if Yiddish was allowed to develop freely, both free from sort of the pejorative and stereotypical opinions of Jews and non-Jews, but also from the political repression, which Yiddish was subject to pretty much wherever it was spoken. Peretz is a recurring character within Edenia, not as a living character, but as an icon. So there are statues of him, there are universities named after him, there are schools named after him.
In terms of being able to write about utopia, at least to some extent, requires a belief that the world can be changed, even if we don't believe that we can accomplish utopia as we may envisage it within our lifetimes or within several lifetimes. There is still some sort of belief that this is an end goal that is possible ultimately, and that is worth, if not fighting for and using less militant language, worth working towards. And something that I've found in some of the, whether Jewish or not, political movements that I sympathize with today, whether on a local or greater level, is sometimes a little bit of disbelief that it's actually possible to change things, apart from just having, you know, a little bit of a safe space of people that already agree on something, and therefore we have to sort of deal with the outside world by connecting together and having that sort of space for ourselves. I'm not saying that this is not important by any means. Everybody deserves to be in a place where they do not have to contest certain things and ways, and they feel confident that way, especially if they're connected to their personal identity. That's completely understandable. But it is also, I think, quite strongly necessary to try and fight for that better world. And that also means sometimes, you know, contesting different spaces and challenging adversities. And so, you know, when you look at not necessarily visions that would call themselves utopian, because when you look at the history of 19th century socialism, there is a very strong divide between people that they call themselves utopian socialists, or they are called utopians, and then there'll be people that are saying, no, we are scientific socialists. Regardless of where you might find yourself in that semantic and political debate, there's nevertheless the belief that despite the circumstances being very dire, and by all means, especially when you're looking at 19th century, early 20th century Yiddish speakers, most of whom would live in the Russian Empire, the situation would have been very dire for them, whatever their utopia may be. What do you think comes out from these writings that would state that despite the situation being as difficult as they are, we should still try and imagine not just what we are against, because that was very easy for them to define, but what do we believe? What do we want to work towards? And that's not necessarily something that the utopian writer has to do. The utopian writer can envisage their vision of what they want society to be to some extent, but also by implication, how do we get there and what do we need to do? How is that expressed in these writings?
I'd actually love to share something I've translated from Morris Meyer's A Jewish Utopia, A Plan for the Reconstruction of the Jewish Folk. So he's trying to write an institutional design plan for what sort of a diasporic world Jewish political structure might look like. And he writes, from Plato's Republic to Bellamy's In the Year 2000 and Herzl's Judenstadt, every utopia, the work of Thomas More, Robert Owens, and the French utopian Saint-Simon, Fourier, Blanqui included, have given various movements of the folk masses and government leaders material for programs and reforms. Maybe my Yiddish utopia will serve this purpose. There's a sense in which anytime you're imagining a more ideal society, what you're trying to do is provide people with goalposts and guidelines for that transition, right? So we might think of this as being the constructive function of utopia. You're trying to say, here's a set of institutions that I've imagined might fit together. Feel free to pick and choose. And often these thinkers provide transition stories as well. So Zingman's transition story, of course, is that there's a government bankruptcy, then there's a subsequent revolution after the Russian Revolution of 1917. And then after that revolution, you get Edenia. But along with this constructive function of utopia, you also have critical function of utopia, which operates sort of by holding a mirror are up to the readers. So you would say, this is my more ideal vision of a society that doesn't exist, and try to bring it to life through a narrative, fiction. And then the readers are drawn out of their own reality and are able to look back more critically on both the good and bad aspects of their life. And so I think what Zingman and other people writing utopias around this time, and there weren't that many that I was able to find sort of explicitly full-throated utopian works. People are hesitant, as you said, about this label. But what's trying to do is to draw people out of their circumstances so that they can look back on their life in diaspora in the Russian Empire and say, these are the aspects that we think, if idealized, if used as a basis for institutional design and social organization, could be a constructive basis for a different sort of society.
I think when we think about the term utopia in the way you're using it, it's really easy to kind of picture the utopian dream of like a Marxist-Leninist or an anarchist. And maybe it might be not so easy for some listeners to picture what these might look like, whether it's workplace democracy or whatever that might look like, or a vanguard party establishing state control and central planning of the economy or whatever that might look like. But the Jewish dimension of these might not be so clear. And in my own research, I've studied a similar period to what you've studied. Many scholars have looked at the history of the Jewish left and kind of noted three different strains of thought vaguely around Jewish leftists' approach to their Jewishness. And these can be broadly classified as Zionists or Hebraicists, as you use the term, Yiddishists or diasporists, which I think is a term that we would use or think about in different ways depending on the cultural context, and then assimilationists, which a lot of the Marxist-Leninist communists would broadly fit into, but also a lot of immigrants coming into the United States kind of gradually dissolved into this assimilationist position. I was wondering, because you've brought up this text, The Jewish Utopia, and I'm really interested if you could kind of go into that. Like, what did that look like, and what is it that makes it particularly diasporist in its vision? And as opposed to the more Hebraicist that might be talking about kibbutzim, or assimilationist that might focus more on establishing state power alongside all the non-Jews that they live among.
Especially considering that Theodor Herzl himself was very prominent in this time, writing Altneuland alongside the Jewish state. That vision of utopia is very important in Zionist thought.
Yeah, you see many more utopias in Zionist thinking, either written in German, if you're thinking about the early ones, or later in Hebrew. And you see both mainstream liberal political Zionists and socialist Zionists and Marxist Zionists writing these utopias. To begin with, I think we should be careful not to conflate the language policies with sort of the political policies. So there are certainly diasporists who didn't have Yiddishist politics, and there are certainly some, though maybe fewer, Zionists who had non-Hebraicist politics. Seem to think that everything but Yiddish would be allowed in the new state. Mm-hmm. So there are those things. But if you look at, so Morris Meyer's sort of utopia, he is not describing a utopian community in the sense we normally think of it. So he is providing a detailed description for an institutional structure that doesn't exist, but he's not describing sort of an intimate, bounded utopian city like Zingman is. What he's imagining maybe aligns more with the focused Dubnov's version of sort of Jewish diasporism. So he's imagining that there is a world Jewish nation already exists, and it's sort of united by what one might call a spirit, but by values, by norms, by shared ideas, by a shared history, potentially by a shared language. And this Jewish nation is spread territorially throughout the world. So you have a hub maybe in the United States that at this point in time is increasing. You have hubs in South America, of course, in Eastern Europe, a little smaller hubs in Palestine at this point, and in Western and Central Europe. And he thinks that each of those will have sort of its own parliamentary structure of Jews in that territory. And they'll elect delegates to a floating congress of the Jewish world nation. And that's a very common institutional vision, which I think is very interesting. Zingman's doing the opposite. So he's not thinking about what a Jewish utopia might look like, or a diaspora utopia might look like on a world scale. He's thinking about what it would mean for the people living in small scale, multinational cities under more ideal conditions.
I also want to ask a little bit about the writers themselves, and as much as they can be considered a category, there's two things that come to mind for me. The first one is that, as all of us here will know and many listeners will know from their own experiences, writing is time-consuming. Not everybody can write an essay or a book. At this time, a lot of people still don't know how to read or write. So to have that possibility, the free time, or maybe the motivation for those of us who would want to write more but feel a little bit too lazy, can't get around to it, not speaking personally there at all. But also there's the second factor there, and that's that being able to just lay out your whole vision is something that you can also treat as a very personal task. And while you might believe that you can't accomplish everything alone, I mean, I assume even utopian writers don't have a god complex, you can't accomplish everything alone. You do recognize that it will be the matter of collective efforts to do so. But the more minds that look at a certain project, the more there can be disagreements and different nuances. And I mean, especially when it comes to, you know, two Jews, three opinions, two socialists, three opinions. So two Jewish socialists is like nine opinions. How would you understand these writers as a category? And also, you know, it's worth asking as well, are there any non-male, non-heteronormative visions of diasporism or utopian visions that come here as well? I assume that there are, at least, if not taking center stage, then ones that by implication could be taken as such.
On the gender question, what comes to mind sort of initially is Esther Frum work on the question of sort of the Jewish folk school. And these aren't, in the sense that I've described, utopias, because they're not detailed descriptions of entire societies that don't yet exist. And for me, sort of that holism of it being a detailed description of all of these aspects of society is very important. But they are really detailed institutional plans. And Esther Frumkin was obviously a really central member in the General Jewish Labor Bund, as many of your listeners will know, I'm sure. And she was the most prolific writer on the question of the Yiddish folk school. And she was engaged in institutional arguments at Chernovitz, right, within the Bund itself, on the Central Committee, all of these other places, arguing about what it would look like to offer Jewish education, whether that would consist of purely secular education, whether it would consist of Jewish education in Yiddish and secular education in the language of the nation in which you were living, all of these various questions. On the question of the degree to which we can think of them as a community, I think we can think of them as sort of a speech community, right? So they're engaging in similar discourses on shared debates. They're trying to answer a shared set of questions. They're trying to think through the issue of what Jews are collectively defined. Daniel Boyerin in The No State Solution sort of humorously said that he wished he had been allowed to call the book What is the Jews? Because the question of collective definition is sort of a puzzling one. They wouldn't let him call it that, of course. But there's the question of collective definition. At this point in time, there's the language question. And this is raised in part because of the assimilationist strand of Jewish political thought. So sort of the Haskalah, the Maskilim, and other assimilationists being really, really hostile to specifically Jewish vernacular. And then you have the question of territory or geography, or the lack of territory and geography. And I think you can think of these writers as a community or as a group because they're all writing along these themes. They, of course, don't agree on anything, even when they're very close to one another. Politically. There is a utopian satire by Sholem Aleichem called The First Yiddish Republic, The First Jewish Republic. 13 Jews are shipwrecked on an island, and they set about to build a Jewish republic, a Jewish state, and they disagree on every question. And each one of them is meant to represent what he saw as a strand of Jewish political thought, or one of the main actors in Jewish politics at that time.
This sounds like the origin story of that Jew on a desert island with two synagogues, except all the other 12 Jews have died already?
Very well could be. There's the refrain of the book is 13 people, 13 opinions, or 13 people, 13 constitutions, or 13 people, 13 colonies, which is a really strange choice given that Sholem Aleichem had sort of a pathological fear of the number 13. He would number his manuscripts 12A and 12B.
Also, on the subject of Esther Frumkin, Treif podcast in their episode on the Bund, episodes on the Bund, I mentioned quite a bit about her. In terms of disagreements, Esther Frumkin becomes involved with the Bolsheviks later on, and she's written out of Bundes history, quite literally, in the 1960s and 70s, when a lot of the activists get down to writing the histories of the movement. They pen three volumes, Generations of Bundes, Deures Bundisten, and Esther Frumkin is not there. One of the most important activists of the First Bund, and also someone who, I forgot who was mentioning on the Treif podcast, but someone who very much could have become the leader of the Bund had she not been a woman, just gets ignored, which is a reminder for all of us on the left to not just follow the sources that we like politically, because they hide their own little issues among them.
Yeah, speaking of that idea, that often following sources might give you a very partial view of the full politics that are involved behind the scenes on that, it made me think about how when I was doing my own research, especially looking at the history of like the anti-parliamentary revolutionary left, I'm going to read a quote from one of the sources that I had that was on a revolutionary conference that took place in 1890. And this was, as I said, anti-parlamentary, anarchist, socialist, leftists. They argued that for anarchism, that they understood as the simplest doctrine in the world. There are scores of systems across society. The anarchists said, "Let us have no systems. The only thing we want is interdependence one upon the other." On that idea, I was wondering how you might understand the limits just focusing on utopian literature and these sort of visions that people put forward, and like what strains of thought would you say might be missing from this sort of view of looking at the history of these movements, and what might you take away as central to all of these utopian writings that might be missing if you don't look at these writings at the broader picture?
Something that's interesting about utopias is the way in which they incorporate aspects of their contemporary historical world, right? So we might think of utopias, or at least utopian fiction and political thought, as always having a contextual function in which it accidentally includes non-ideal features of its world, where it deliberately includes features of its world that it wishes to reproduce in the utopia or encourage, and it engages in the debates of that period in time. So if we think about Zingman's Edenia, almost all of the central streams of Jewish politics in Eastern Europe at that time are represented. In the novel, you have someone returning from Palestine where they're still trying to establish a Jewish state, and it's not going really well because the elite are still oppressing the workers and the workers are raising revolutions. And so you have Zalman Kindishman come back to Edenia, where he grew up when it was still Kharkiv, and his friend Jungenboim is showing him around. And Jungenboim explains that, well, there were anarchists and they held on for a long time after political parties were abolished, but they sort of just withered away. So he doesn't really engage seriously with anarchism, right? And then he does have an incredibly extensive critique of Zionism in a conversation between these two characters, or at least of political as opposed to cultural Zionism.
I like the idea of anarchists like withering away, like, oh yeah, if you're an anarchist, believe the state should wither away. Why don't you like wither away yourself? Got him.
Right, exactly. And he's sort of has, it is a socialist utopia organized according to the need principle as articulated by Marx and Marxists, right? So everyone works according to their ability and receives according to their need. And the only stream of Jewish politics that is completely left out of this utopia is assimilationism. And I think this is a really deliberate choice. It's sort of a way of critically rejecting by not even naming acculturation or assimilation as a Jewish political choice. He's just saying, well, it's not a Jewish idea because you've left. And obviously, there are ways to hide all of those things. It's common for utopias to engage their competitors within the novel and say why their vision is better. But you obviously can just ignore the ones that you don't particularly like.
Is that kind of how you would understand the writing off of anarchism within that text?
Yeah, I think it just wasn't incredibly serious engagement with it. I'm not sure that Zingman read a lot of anarchist thought. I'm actually not incredibly sure about what Zingman read at all, because he was a relatively minor writer and publisher, and not many archival papers exist. And those that do exist simply reveal how difficult his handwriting is to read, and not much else.
That's the worst.
Yiddish handwriting is notoriously difficult to decipher.
I had to recruit the help of our friend Helen Beer.
Bless her heart.
Oh, I can imagine. I did come upon one source during my studies, which was like a little notebook. It was incredible. It was mostly in English, but there was this one page that was just Yiddish cursive, and I was like, there is no way anyone can read this, maybe ever.
No, I can't believe Helen made sense of this letter. It's him asking to be put in the lexicon of Yiddish writers.
I feel like what we need is like Yiddishist doctors. That might help out.
So, kind of thinking about the timeline here, I found in my studies the first sign of like an explicitly Jewish socialism is in the 1870s with Aaron Lieberman's Hebrew Socialist Union in the UK. I'm not sure if that is just of this in the UK or if there was other stuff. I'm sure there was proto-socialist stuff happening within the Pale of Settlement within Eastern Europe. And then the heyday of a Jewish socialism is really, I found in my studies, from late 1880s until the First World War. And then you have the amalgamation into a lot of national movements with the Soviet Revolution in Russia and the way that that impacted Jewish politics there. What time period is a lot of the texts that you focus on coming from? How might you periodize the sort of texts that you're looking at over the course of your studies?
So the utopian texts that I've found are very few, right? So there's Zingman's Edenia, there's Sholem Aleichem's utopian satire, and then there's Morris Meyer's A Yiddish Jewish Utopia. So Zingman is writing in 1918. He's writing just as the Russian Revolution has happened, just World War I is ending, right? And so there's this glimmer of hope at that time that everything could be completely different. So he's writing at the very, very beginning of the interwar period. Morris Meyer writing at pretty much the same time. Sholem Aleichem is writing a satire, which I think is a slightly different thing than a utopian novel or a utopian blueprint. He's writing in, I think, 1905 or 6. Broader work that I do on Yiddish political thought spans pretty much the same time frame that you're looking at. I think it's helpful to think of early stuff is sort of pre-1905. There's a really big shift in what Yiddish language and culture politics look like after the 1905 revolution. And then, of course, there's a really big shift around the Russian Revolution. And then you have another shift, interwar period.
The interesting thing about the character of Aaron Lieberman is that he can be considered both an ancestor of Bundism and Zionism. There's elements of both in there. And also, I always like the fact that one of the first Jewish socialist journals that he published in London, I think in 1876, was called Polischer Jidl, so Little Polish Jew.
That's not Aaron Lieberman, that is actually Morris Winchevsky.
Oh my god,
though
sorry.
There might have been some contributions, but yeah, Polischer Jidl was primarily Winchevsky.
Damn it. I specialize later on. This is why. Yeah. But oh, the thing of Aaron Lieberman, I guess he's not that well known, but it reminds me a little bit of how both the nationalists and the communists in China both venerate Sun Yat-sen, their founding father, in just completely different, well, very different streams of thought. It is such an interesting time period with so many different movements happening at the time.
What is interesting about the Hebrew Socialist Union, it lasted only like 6 months in 1876. Some of the accounts I've read have basically said that it split because there were disagreements, cultural disagreements between the Lithuanian Jews and the Galician Jews, who like the Galicians saw the Lithuanians as like that thought they were all smarter than them. And like there was sort of like a divide that you could see that's kind of between like more white collar workers and blue collar workers, as we might say. And it is kind of interesting to think about the sort of ways that different groups of Jews end up competing and end up seeing themselves in different lights based on where they might be coming from. And of course, this can reproduce itself in different places in different ways. I mean, that happens all over the place with the existing Jewish community in Britain, of course, dividing itself from the immigrant Jewish communities, and this happened in all the lands of diaspora, especially France.
I forgot which one it was. It was either the Board of Deputies or the Jewish Chronicle that condemned the Hebrew Socialist Union, so that counts as a massive W, despite its short existence.
Oh yeah, no, you're not wrong. It was the Jewish Chronicle that called the Hebrew Socialist Union as non-Jews, missionaries, and enemies of Jews.
That's right.
So you can kind of see the way that the official mainstream communal voices are going to, of course, marginalize a group like this, and I think we still see this today with the way that especially anti-Zionist Jews get seen as non-Jews or enemies or traitors. I mean, that's the term that I've heard used a lot. I do kind of want to take this up to today because you've talked a lot about the history here and the visions that people put forward in their own contexts as far as 100 years ago or more. How does your reading of these texts, your studying of these texts, influence your thinking about what is possible today and where we should be headed as left-wing Jews in a world that is vastly, vastly different?
For me, these texts are especially helpful in thinking through what our positive vision might be, right? So, of course, a lot of us are attracted to Yiddish and other diasporic languages because of their associations with the parties and movements and histories that we're interested in. But in these Yiddish texts of political theory that I don't think have been sufficiently studied as political theory, there are also really interesting proposals for how we might institutionally organize our lives. So there are maybe two of Zingman's institutional interventions that are particularly interesting, as he has council system in which different national councils manage the cultural institutions, the schools, the universities in their own language, but then send delegates to the central municipal council, which is collectively responsible for the governance of the city or the shared community. And then you also have that supplemented by workers' councils drawn from multilingual, multinational workspaces, from neighborhood associations. He sort of tries to take Doakate to the extreme and says, you know, the place where your interests are most immediately concentrated are the workplace and the neighborhood, both of which in his utopian vision are integrated. So those sorts of small-scale organizational structures that allow us to think about our own communities in a really intimate way, I think, are informative. There's also a lot to draw from the critical function of utopia, right? So we can draw from their critiques of Zionism, many of which I think are still relevant today. They almost often seem readily applicable.
Can you kind of spell out what that critique is?
So Zingman in Edenia makes what I think of as three principal critiques. So he makes a disunity critique, and he's arguing in making that critique that if you take Zionism on its own terms, despite its professed aim of trying to unify the Jewish nation, it will deepen divisions of class, divisions of language, and introduce a schism between the Jewish state and the diaspora, ultimately creating a Jewish polity for Zingman, an exclusively Jewish state, as opposed to sort of a new diasporic hub, throws off the balance of the diaspora. So he thinks it's fine if people want to move to Palestine. He's not completely opposed. He's sort of like Dubnov in this regard and other cultural spiritual Zionists, but he thinks Jewish polity would throw off the whole balance, right? So that's the disunity critique. There's also a non-negation critique. So he wants to challenge the desirability of the professed goal of negating the diaspora. And of course, we know that in a very literal sense, Zionism has not negated the diaspora, right? We all live still in diaspora, but we might think about today the degree to which Zionism as culturally tried to negate diaspora cultures. That really impairs our vision of other forms of Jewish cultural life, other forms of Jewish politics that are possible. It's almost impossible for many people to imagine otherwise. There's also a normalization critique. So what Zingman is arguing in the normalization critique is that the idea of normalizing Jews might be better achieved by rejecting the status quo of the nation state and changing the status of the diaspora by introducing multinational states and national cultural autonomy, right? So what Zingman in that critique is arguing is that diaspora is not only a descriptive term, right? So it's not saying we're merely dispersed across the world and that's what we're describing. It's a political situation. It's a political situation which you're necessarily sharing territory, communities, political institutions with other people that are unlike you. And I think that's the state that we really all find ourselves in, regardless of whether you live in Palestine or in the Golis, right? You're living in multinational states, whether they're explicitly multinational states or not. These are his principal critiques of Zionism. One of the things that I find useful about these is it reminds us that Israel or Jewish state or the Zionist project has never had a unified, settled, agreed upon place in Jewish life. And there's always been this manifold diversity of visions, both of what Jewish political organization should look like and of what Zionism really meant. And we sort of have a flattened one-dimensional sense today because that's the one that's triumphed, right? Sort of a vulgar, chauvinist, ethno-nationalist political Zionism. But we might also have lessons to learn from spiritual and cultural Zionism.
Triumphed for now, at least in some ways more than others. In terms of other visions that we can look at today, quite recently we've hosted Joe Feinberg and his Declaration of Independence of the Diaspora. What do you think that the writers of the visions of the early 20th century would have thought of that as a document?
That's really hard to say. I'm, as someone who works on history, always so cautious of putting words into the mouths of the people I study.
Yeah, yeah. And as a historian myself, I realize that this is a very difficult question to ask academically and to not reduce you to a pop historian. Let me rephrase. What similarities do you think can be found in the visions of today, as people who worked on the declaration can be found?
So we today are engaged in sort of the same project. The Declaration of the Independence of the Diaspora is an articulation similar to the ones we find in Edenia, similar to the ones we find in the Bund, of a positive vision of diasporic life, right? And not just of the idea that things could be better in the diaspora, but that features of diasporic life could actually be idealized and used as a basis for organizing communal life, right? So you have Jewish communities in Eastern Europe, in Iraq, Iran, right, everywhere, where you've had integrated communities of Jews and non-Jews who have lived together and known each other's languages, who have shared cultural institutions and neighborhoods and political institutions. And that's really one of the features of diaspora that we're encouraged to forget. There are lots of things wrong with diaspora, and anyone who reads Yiddish poetry, anyone who reads Yiddish fiction knows that. But there are also features of diasporic life that are generative for political possibilities. And I think that's something that a lot of us are missing out on when we're thinking about what it means to have a diasporic politics today. So the new Jewish diasporic turn, if we want to call it that, is really oriented, as I see it, towards identity. So you have Judith Butler's Parting Ways, you have Daniel Boyerin's No State Solution, even Shaul Magid's The Necessity of Exile. All of these sort of want to reorient our relationship to Israel, to Zionism, by reorienting Jewish identity. And I think that's insufficient without proposing political institutions and policies and organizations that can solve very real problems of either sort of forced or coerced assimilation, but also of anti-Semitism. And it's not enough to simply have a diasporic Jewish identity, though it's very important. And it can be really consoling and cheering, and that's incredibly important, but it also has to be a political vision.
I think as well, when it comes to imagining Yiddish, not just as a folk tradition, but also as a language that is spoken and spoken by people of all different backgrounds, not just people who only live in an environment where that is the main vernacular, like it may be in the Hasidic world. But that vision of going beyond the individual and towards proposing, as you say, political institutional action is something that needs to be considered strongly if it is to bear fruit. So what I mean by that is that it's one thing to create a Yiddish space or space for analyzing Yiddish thought, but if you want to take it away from just a small group of people who are interested in the first place and towards influencing how mainstream Jewish communal life and culture relates to it, that in itself is a political choice and it requires organizing. And so if you look at the ways in which that was advanced historically in the late 19th and early 20th century, we see different blueprints and visions of that which can be understood to be more or less relevant today. And for me, the idea of national cultural autonomy, despite so many differences to Jewish life in diaspora and even within Israel-Palestine, still holds that special place, specifically when you look at Vladimir Medem's articulation of it being very much a voluntary association. It was very radical then and still remains so, a voluntary association of people within any nationality that they can join on the same territory.
I might also add that I think your recounting of Zingman's model at the local level in Edenia, where he talks about all these nationalities having their own councils that then nominate delegates that come to the municipal council, as well as having workers' councils and neighborhood councils that all are integrated into one council system, is perhaps the most concrete articulation we've had of national cultural autonomy yet. And I think there's something that's really powerful about having that utopian narrative that says this is how it could be done, that does inspire action, that does inspire organizing towards thinking about how we might do this. Because so often in conversations when we're talking about national cultural autonomy, it feels like it's not developed. It feels like we don't know how this could be done and how it might be integrated into a wider, like what you could call council communist system, which it sounds like Zingman's already done. There is a lot of record of showing that people have thought about this stuff, and it's not like we have to reinvent the wheel. And I think in that way, a utopian literature can really play a big role in inspiring that action and opening our eyes to the realms of possibility that exist.
Definitely. That's one of the amazing things about utopian literature is that even where detailed plans and debates within parties and parliaments exist, utopias are able to bring to life those debates in a way that makes us imagine what it would be like to live within them. So I also think that national cultural autonomy is a really generative source of inspiration for political organization today. Another place to look if you're interested in more sort of concrete visions of what that might look like is the debates on the Kahila system that came after Dubnov published one of his letters. I think there are 13 letters, an old and new Jewry, that were published over the course of maybe a decade. And in one of them, he lays out his vision of national cultural autonomy and proposes that we revive sort of this 16th century autonomous Jewish organization called the Kahal or the Kahila system. And you have everyone, there's this outpouring of Jewish political thinkers writing in Yiddish and sometimes in Russian and Polish about this. So Medem has a response in which he says, okay, don't really love the idea, but like we'll participate in them. That's okay. And then some of the folk party partisans are really, really excited about this system. And so I think that there are a lot of much more concrete visions, but they're often closed off to us either through linguistic barriers or in archives. And that's one of the things we lose when we're drawn to Yiddish only as a symbol of diasporic identity, is we lose the richness of the political thought in the language. We lose in some ways the language itself, if we allow Yiddish to be purely a cultural phenomenon as opposed to a language that we study really seriously.
I've alluded to this a little bit in the beginning, but now, Sophie, you brought it up exactly in conversations that we had before. I came across this passage by Medem. This was in Russian, translated into Polish, and then now I tried to make it back into English. But the specific passage that Medem writes about the Jewish communal authority around 1908-1909, more or less goes as follows, and I'll take the liberty of citing here since both of you guys cited your quotes, so we're all intellectuals over here. No matter how horrific these institutions are, he's talking about the Jewish mainstream communal institutions, no matter how horrific these institutions are, they nevertheless remain organs of self-government, and the road to autonomous self-government leads through these institutions, because autonomy is primarily a kahila, and this is a little bit unclear of the translation here. The autonomy is mainly a kahila, but a kahila more democratic, enriched by new tasks and freed of old ones. It should become a bridge between them, and our future political activity should focus on it. Of course, talking about the Bund. And I think that this is, at the very least, a good conversation starter when it comes to current Jewish left engagement within the community, our communities, wherever we may live. There's other things that go beyond the sort of visions of utopia and philosophical ideas and go into practical realities when you look at the Bunds organizing within mainstream Jewish communal institutions in the 1930s. But that's not the subject that we are going on today. And we are approaching the hour. So,
I mean, I think one last thing to end on is, we kind of started with as well, oh my god, beautiful dog.
Say hello. She's been very good for the hour, so she's,
my goodness, oh.
There was a bunny outside and she's anxiously keeping guard. It's bigger than she is, so it's a really threatening intruder.
Why haven't we seen her yet?
Say hi.
There, baby. This is,
oh, see, like, I wanna include that photo as the episode art.
We could do that if she stops near.
We are definitely keeping this in, by the way, and everyone who's listening will not be able to see
the Yiddish dog. All right, sit.
I mean, I just wanted to end on a question going back to the idea of utopianism as a strain of thought that is often considered pejorative, that is kind of overlooked by those that consider themselves scientific socialists. What would you say in regard to someone that might say, oh, utopias are not realistic, this isn't something, we need to be scientific, we need to be focused on how we get from point A to point B rather than just focusing on that vision? What would you say in defense of utopia?
Ooh. So if you'll let me be really political theorist about this, I think there are three principal arguments against utopianism that sort of Marxist or scientific socialists make or depend on. So the first is that we just don't have the right knowledge. We somehow lack some sort of epistemological knowledge that we need in order to imagine what the future looks like. Therefore, we should just allow history to take its course and the right sort of institutions will just come to be out of the old. And so one of the problems with this, I think, sorry, Moxie's trying to eat some things. The problem with this view is that utopias are not meant to be predictions of the future, right? They're meant to be generative sources of potential political ideas. They're ways to model, they're thought experiments, they're ways to critique our present, but they're not predictions. So we don't need to demand of them that they be predictions. Another critique of utopias is that they're undemocratic, that somehow by having someone create this plan, it precludes all of these other possibilities for the future. And I think we can reject that argument as well. I think the mere existence of plans, right, doesn't preclude other options for the future. The third argument against utopias tend to be that they're just sort of unnecessary or they're redundant because the future is going to be whatever it's going to be. And the new socialist society is going to be born out of the old and the proletariat's going to be the handmaiden to that revolution, as Marx might want to put it with his fondness of birthing metaphors. There's not a lot of historical evidence that that's how that works, right? We need to, as Jerry Cohen, the analytical Marxist, put it, write recipes for the cookshops of the future so that we can get what we want when it comes time to eat. And if we don't write those plans, we have no idea that we're going to get what we want to eat.
And Marx himself done goofed up a little bit in my understanding of not really spelling out a little bit of a vision of what comes after the capitalism overthrow happens. And that has taken us down historically a few different roads that we might want to avoid going forward. Thank you so much for coming on, Sophie.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks very much. This was really wonderful.
We are beautiful people.